Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You once again, I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Stop Child Abuse Now, SCAN, radio show number 3391. My name is Annie Morges, and I'm one of your co-hosts tonight. And the SCAN radio show is brought to us by NASCA, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And I always begin by reading the NASCA mission statement to talk about what we're all about. We have a single purpose at NASCA, to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. One, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, CSA. Presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. Two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Okay. And Dr. Rommel, is that you here? Jaime?
Yes, it's me.
Okay, hello? Just making sure. I saw your phone number. I thought that was you. Welcome. Okay, I'm going to go on with the rest of the intro. On Thursdays, we have a call-in discussion with a survivor professional using an open mic forum. We feature a survivor professional co-host who will field topics brought to the episode by you, the listener. Tonight, the special co-host is Jaime Romo, Dr. Jaime Romo. On these episodes, we welcome various co-hosts and survivor professionals who will assist in fielding questions and lead a variety of topics suggested by our call-in participants. Their trauma-informed perspective as survivor professionals help them guide discussions on the issues of child abuse, trauma, and healthy human sexuality that spring from questions and topics brought to us by our listeners. Everyone's invited to engage in tonight's show, and the way that you do that is by calling in. The phone number to call is 646-595-2118. And I'll be the one in the background who will let you into the radio show. So don't be afraid, it's just me. And we have a topic tonight. I'll tell you our topic, and then I'll turn it over to Dr. Romo. Our topic tonight is end of life, issues for survivors of childhood abuse. How is it different for us? Well, that's our little topic. And with that, hi, Dr. Romo.
Hi, Annie.
Welcome, welcome. We have a couple of other people on the line with us tonight, so that's great.
Awesome. Would you like me to kind of begin, and then we can just have a larger conversation?
Yeah, I'd like you to introduce yourself because the little thing didn't have a bio on it for me to read.
Oh, no problem.
So if you'd introduce yourself and then get started. Yes, please. I'll mute everybody else. Okay.
Thanks. So currently, and I think how this topic is kind of present today, is that my current role is that I'm a hospice chaplain. That wasn't something I had planned on, and so I'll back up. You know, so there's that currently. There's the childhood abuse and trauma. So I grew up violent alcoholic home. Lots of insecurity. We're hungry. The neighborhood was violent. Church and school. I went to a Catholic elementary school. Was our safe space, and so that's where I was groomed and later sexually abused by the pastor and someone else from the diocese, which was suppressed for many years, partly because of alcohol and partly because that's a coping mechanism, you know, not intentional. But it was when I was a professor later, teaching teachers, in 2002, that Boston clergy scandals in the news. I was on the East Coast. It triggered these memories and kind of had to deal with them. At the time, I thought, because I was a professional, because I had done some previous work related to, you know, alcohol violence in the family, that I was ready to be the resource and take care of everybody else, in which I attempted, but cost me. And so when I had PTSD, I had to face my own experience and find healing. I think previously my coping had been through overwork and through, you know, channeling rage and achieving. So became eventually connected with a group in SAMHSA that looked at males in trauma recovery, connected to a group that I experienced a treatment, it's not a therapeutic treatment, it's more educational, called traumatic incident reduction, which was the most effective thing that I had done when I had PTSD, and became eventually a facilitator and now a trainer. I moved into the field of trauma and became a subject matter expert with NASBIT as one of the groups, the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, and then unexpectedly came into this role when my dad was in hospice about 8 years ago, and I found it very powerful and integrating. And all these background experiences, my own spiritual roots, my understanding of learning and human development, my understanding and firsthand experience of trauma and post-traumatic growth, all come together as I visit with patients. And I see a clear, unfortunate, you know, crisis when people have suppressed their memories of abuse or have kind of coped in different ways. You know, whether it's some form of addiction. The young man in his 20s that I saw today, who's in hospice because of his own self-destructive behaviors. On the other hand, I can see people in their 80s and 90s, and when they have not fully faced a lot of their own experiences of both what happened to them as well as maybe what they have done to others as a result, find people in what we call, you know, spiritual distress, or especially in the case of sexual abuse, we call it moral injury. It's a term used when people in war, you know, come back and have seen and committed, you know, been a part of atrocities that cut at their deepest self, call it their soul, right, this moral injury. And to say a few words to, you know, background kind of formally about trauma and how it relates to people at end of life. So we know trauma, one definition comes from the Greek word, excuse me, that means not just to wound, but to pierce, like rupturing the skin. And we think of, you know, the skin is our container, who we are, you know, and so when that, on a physical level especially, is broken, our boundaries can be really disrupted. It could certainly be emotional or spiritual boundaries as well. But often people feel helpless by force in many cases. They may have physical reactions because the body responds to the threat of violence and death in the early parts of our lives. And we have such survival drive. And so we have all that chemical reaction going on. We have physical reactions. And then we have emotional, you know, feelings of helplessness and anxiety. And those can get triggered when they're, you know, in us still, and we haven't faced and transformed those experiences. So we have these responses that, you know, are catastrophic, and we catastrophize things. And in our reaction without thinking about it. And the deepest one, though, for me, is that when we have our sense of self ruptured, you know, overwhelmed, we can lose a sense of not just control, but a sense of connection with ourselves and with others, and meaning. And so this is where, at end of life, it really becomes a crisis, you know, when people start to wonder, you know, what's the meaning of my life? You know, and the fears that come up, not just in their current situation, because I see plenty of people who, I mean, it sounds extreme, and it's not as common, you know, but people who laugh, and who one person's, you know, he said, dying is fun, because we would have these conversations, and he was just so present and so appreciative, like he had never been, about every day and all the life experiences he had. He just, it was a chance to kind of to do these life reviews and savor it all. But when people are not able to fully face this, there's that disconnect. And there's a, you might think of it as, like instead of PTSD, post-traumatic stress injury, you know, that is behind our current experiences. So there's the current threat to end of this life, and so some people can face that and accept it and be in the present, and others may want to face that, but they've got all this background stuff that hasn't been faced. And there's the image of, I'm not sure if you've seen in railroad crossings, maybe a sign that says, caution, one train may hide another. And that image is, to me, really helpful, because often we think we're dealing with the issue at hand only. Okay, so end of life is a serious, amazingly huge, you know, experience to face. And people can face that and face it with peace and have a sense of, you know, whether they believe in an afterlife or not, have a sense of peace and presence and gratitude. But if there's something behind that train, right, that we're not able to see, then that there's something that's anxiety producing, you know, because the meaning of that experience hasn't really been brought forward. So religious or not, I think a difference maker is whether we've allowed ourselves to fully face our past, that allows us to fully face our present or our future. And so there's an expression in when we don't fully face our experiences, in a sense, we betray the past. And if we don't fully face our experiences, in a sense, we can't appreciate, the mystery or the beauty, the amazing, whatever is next, whether it's in hospice situation, end of life, or not. And so my role in the hospice role is always to help the person to, in their bodies, in their minds, and in their spirit, to be at peace. Often, and I bring this up to the team a lot, we deal sometimes with very complex cases where people have been living in the streets for a while, and the background for that has been all kinds of trauma and abuse that led maybe to addictions and coping behaviors that amounted, added up, and so even then, medication intended to help a person physically, to not have so much pain, might not be effective, let alone, being able to just in their mind, just to be present and be able to, to go forward. That's not uncommon. Vietnam vets, have a kind of trauma, and there's a correlation between, PTSD with vets who have it correlated to previous life experiences that have not been resolved, compared to those who don't have that background trauma and then go into this, very overwhelming, traumatic, dangerous, life-threatening situation, and their recovery time or their ability to not be overwhelmed and have PTSD is very different. And so in a lot of ways, peace is found through fully facing our life experiences. And even if it's not in detail, it's a helpful beginning when someone can at least acknowledge as a starting point something and speak the unspeakable, I would say, that allows them somehow to let go of that and find peace. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Thank you. I have a page of notes that I wrote. Thank you. All right. I'm going to introduce our guests. We have two guests, and I'll call on Cindy first. Let me unmute her. Hi, Cindy. Are you there? Maybe I have the name wrong.
Hey there. No, you don't have the name wrong. It just took me a minute to...
Oh, there you are.
Get the phone.
Hi.
Unlock my screen. Hi. Yeah.
Would you like to
comment?
Comment on what Dr. Romo had to say, or just give
just how lovely and amazing to sit with people in kind of the end stage of this experience. So thank you for doing that. I think it's profound in within the topic of this show, and talking about child abuse and, it's different for everybody, and some people are lucky to be able to heal in their relationships with their parents and then whether or not, I guess most of the time people don't have their parents, right? Because more usually parents would go before that person anyway. But if you've been, like my situation, I was abused by a lot of people, not my mom, because I was taken from my mom as a little baby. And, so other people are important, really, really important. And if you grew up in a sort of intact, safe, loving home, and you're dying, you probably still need somebody to sit there with you, and none of those people that you grew up with may be around anymore. And so I don't want to be like, you know, those people don't need that type of support, but it is different to have not had that type of loving, nurturing that you get as a baby. And it does affect you in every single stage of your life, I think, to some degree. And, you know, I used to work in childcare, and I always remember this one moment where mom was dropping off her three-year-old, and mom's having a harder time than the three-year-old because it was like the first day of preschool. And she just said to him, "Remember, mommy's always in your heart." And he just looked at her and nodded. And that completely made sense to that little three-year-old, even though they're not supposed to be capable of abstract thought like that. And if you can find that connection inside of you, you know, and I think about, you know, how different it might have been to think about my mother if my mother had been the one that I could remember hurting me, you know. And so it's kind of, it's a lot. Like, I'd like to be able to summarize that beautifully, and it's hard. Like, I get stuck there when I think about that. And I guess it's okay, right? It's like everything doesn't always have to be great or wonderful in order to also find the joy and appreciation in life and in what love is being offered to you or is inside of you. Sorry, that was really long.
No, may I,
no, no.
May I comment? Cindy?
Please.
Yeah, I mean, it brought up a couple things that I think are super helpful. And one, it reminded me of the idea when you bring up the mom who said, "Don't, you know, I'll always be in your heart," and how comforting that was. There are studies in kind of war situations. In World War II in London, there were some studies, you know, with the bombing and so on, about kids who had a sense that they had a protective shield with them, right? The parent was physically shielding them or with them. And those kids ended up kind of doing better psychologically, like in this, you know, crazy, dangerous situation. After 9/11, there were follow-up studies, you know, about the parents and how they were doing and how the kids were doing. And when the kids, there was a correlation when they didn't know how the kids were doing, you know, after 9/11, it was clear that those kids also had and were more impacted. Right? And so there's something really powerful, even in that word, you know, "I'll always be in your heart." You know, it's more like symbolic presence and shielding, but more the physical. You know, so it really brings up how powerful it is that we have someone who is with us, who's got our back in some way, that we know that. And that it doesn't have to, in fact, it may not be, you know, the parent or someone right there physically. So that was one thing. It just really struck me. What a great and powerful example that is, that has some research connected to it. How powerful when we have a protective shield. And just the follow-up thought with that is like, so it's on us then to provide that in some way, you know, to create it or, you know, to develop it. And that brings up my second thought. I'll be real brief. This idea of like, yeah, I wish that would have happened. I have a loss of, you know, a loving parent. I have a loss of a safe environment. And that did have a huge impact. Right? And so, you know, grief is the response to having lost something that's really important. And there's these three images about how we over time can experience this grief is lost differently, because I think a lot of people might think, well, over time our grief gets less, but I think to me the better image is over time the grief stays the same, but we grow. And so if you think of like an image of a jar with a tennis ball and it, you know, kind of fills up the jar, stage one, you know, that immediate loss, grief is just taken over. Next image is jar, same tennis ball, but the jar is bigger. There's a little bit more space. And the next jar, same tennis ball, the jar is bigger. And so we may never lose that kind of grief, that loss, that reality, but we grow. And that's where we can be then the protective shield or have more around that experience that allows us to have that grief in a different way. So maybe it's, you know, terrible at first, or maybe it's bittersweet, and then maybe it's actually, you know, just part of our compassion, our love, and who we are. So anyway, I really appreciate what you shared and brought up a bunch of stuff for me. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Dr. Romo, and thank you, Cindy. And let's go to our other caller. Let me push the button here. Hello, other caller. Is that you, Robbie?
Well, I'm here, but I think I heard another gentleman's voice, maybe.
No, that was probably just... I can hear you.
Oh, that might have... maybe that was Jamie. I don't know.
Yeah, could be. Would you like to comment on what Dr. Romo had to say or what Cindy said, or just comment on your own thoughts on this topic?
I'll do a little bit of both. You can hear me, because the only reason I ask that I'm on speakerphone, that's just easier for me so you guys can hear me.
We can hear you, but it might be better if you weren't on speakerphone.
Okay, well then let me get off of that and see how's that.
I think that's better.
Is that better?
Yeah, clearer.
Are you there again?
I'm here.
I couldn't hear you when I took you off speakerphone. Isn't that weird?
Oh. Well, we can hear you all right.
What's that?
We'll just live with it as it is.
Okay. Well, like I said, I took the speakerphone off and I put my ear up to the phone and I still couldn't hear anything. So, if you can hear me, I really appreciated what Jamie said. There was a lot of stuff in there. I think the molestation from the church, I think, is super, super duper heinous, because especially as young people are, you know, looking for security and spiritual guidance, it's a tremendous betrayal, and I can imagine that would be extremely hurtful. I mean, that's like not even a good enough word, like a huge wound. And you know, I came from a very alcoholic oriented family, and my mother and father, I would say, were not in love with each other, but it was the time of where you didn't get divorced, and you know, you stay for the kids and all that kind of stuff. And you know, I have a litany of things I can talk about relating to that, but I guess one thing I wanted to say was, because it was relating with hospice care and whatnot, I lost my brother about a year ago, and he died in his sleep, and my partner lost his sister to diabetes. And so it was kind of a big, kind of a shock to us. But at the same time, I don't know. The thing about grief for me, I tried like every kind of self-help thing you could ever imagine, you know, EST and NLP and recently Transcendental Meditation and even ketamine. I tried some of that stuff. And I realized some of what I need to do, and I'm not telling anybody else how to, you know, deal with their grief or whatever, but a lot of it for me was kind of accepting what's there and letting it heal as it's supposed to, I guess, in a way. I mean, I'm not into denial. I don't drink. I don't, you know, I'm not really escaping from anything, but, you know, just trying to get on with my life. And, you know, I'm I'm going to be 64 in May, so I've kind of had to look at the time frame of my life and really had to let go of a lot of things and expectations of how I wish things were different. But at the same time, I've managed to do what I want for a living and you know, have a lot of decent friends and, you know, take the blessings where they come and realize that life is neither all light or nor all dark, I guess, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, may I comment? Add to it and join?
Please, I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Well, thanks. Well, first, you know, what you said about betrayal, that's so accurate, right? And I guess there are more branches, right, of trauma, right? There's, you know, from sudden events, there's neonatal, you know, in the womb that, you know, the mother can have trauma and then it carries on, you know, with epigenetics, and there's intergenerational and there's historical and there's developmental. There's also betrayal trauma, right? So the people who are supposed to protect us, those authority figures who represented whatever our sense of higher power or God, that they would, on one hand, abuse, you know, in different ways, physically, emotionally, sexually, or not intervene, not protect, not be that protective shield. So of course, you know, authority figures, whether they're religious, you know, although that has a particular weight because, at least in some, you know, groups or families or, you know, communities, that is like the highest form of authority. But whatever the form of authority, yeah, betrayal is, you know, deep injury to it. So I just want to, like, say yes, right on. That's.
And heart goes out to you for that, my friend.
Well, you know, thank you. I mean, that's when it goes back to fully facing. I mean, I have had the privilege of knowing so many people who have, you know, I'll mention ritual abuse. And we're talking about not just religious, but where groups use actual rituals as kind of like this ceremony to abuse kids. I know people who have experienced all kinds of physical and sexual abuse, and because they have fully faced them, and in different ways, you know, can be helpful. So I'll just leave it at that for now. But they do not regret. I do not regret my past. I think it was, you know, shitty and horrible. The things, you know, shouldn't have happened. Adults responsible for my safety and well-being were not either capable or were just outright abusive of that trust and authority. And, you know, I have developed a skill set, a perspective, and, you know, you mentioned AST and TM, and, you know, I've developed a spiritual life that I always had, but I think I'm very grounded. I mean, the more integration I can always do, it's not like it's all done. But anyway, all that is like, yeah, it becomes, there's post-traumatic growth, I guess is what I'm saying. And part of that, what you mentioned, you know, just letting go of things, that, you know, when I talk to patients at the end of life, sometimes we go through kind of a reflection, a kind of a ritual about letting go, about forgiveness. And it's not like forgiving the people who did whatever or should have done whatever. It's not kind of letting them off the hook so much, but it's letting ourselves let go of that stuff that gets in the way of just being peace or being present or being, you know, connected to what's most important. And so that letting go piece, however, you know, meditation can help us to have a little bit more space between what our mind is doing and those memories or our worries, gives us the practice of being at peace, of letting go, not being so attached to those things. So forgiveness, I think, is a deep gift and practice, and I just want to highlight what an important thing. However we can get to that point, it doesn't mean, again, letting others off the hook for and being accountable, as people should be who do horrible things to kids or anybody. But for us, that we don't have that be the fuel in us. And so I think it's not a trap, but maybe something that happens a lot of times, especially to survivors of sexual abuse, child sexual abuse, is that people can burn with a rage. I mean, I certainly did. You know, whether it was as a high school athlete, killing people on a soccer field or competing in other ways and, never trusting, never really feeling safe, and channeling that in hopefully productive ways, sometimes self-destructive ways, but that was a fuel. And sometimes adult survivors, when they advocate for others, hold on to that fuel and that rage with the idea that maybe if we let go of it, somehow we'll be betraying others, like we will be dishonoring, the struggle that others are in and feeling. And it's self-destructive. I mean, there are a lot of survivors who do good work who abandon themselves in the process and are abusive to themselves in the process and never really let go of the shame because it still is fueling, like rage. So forgiveness is letting ourselves be present to ourselves, letting go of what gets in the way. And that's certainly end of life, something that is a focus for me. But I think throughout our life, it's about how do we live, and part of that is fully facing and then in different ways, unpacking it, taking what's useful, letting go of the rest, and using what's useful as an amazing resource. So, thank you.
Can I interject something else? Because you were saying something in
me. Yeah.
I'm certain, what am I trying to say? In terms of my own letting go, I think maybe people get confused. I know I certainly have. Sometimes I think that letting go is letting go of the charge that's on it, but that doesn't mean, like what you said, that, when you forgive somebody, that doesn't mean that you give them the right to trespass against you again or that you forget, because it makes you who you are. And Can I share a quick little story of something that was kind of blew my mind, I guess, in a way? When I was 12 years old, I don't know why this happened, but my brother and I went to a swap meet, and my brother was 5 years older than me, so he was 17, and we bought knives. And, who the heck sells knives to a 17-year-old and a 12-year-old? But yeah. My brother stabbed me. He got mad at me. And I almost bled to death. And I'm not trying to say this for the drama of it, but, I had applied my own tourniquet, and I remember my mother took a Thorazine tablet and went to the bedroom and slept it off, and then my dad came home, and he realized that I had been on the couch for hours, so he didn't take me to the emergency room until after he had his dinner. But this is a horrible, horrible story. But, I have this scar where my brother had, almost severed one of my arteries in my leg. And I can say this now, and I'm not going to go cry, and I don't even mean that I should or shouldn't. Mm-hmm. But, my brother was very much the black sheep of the family, and he was actually killed by police by wielding a knife at them about 6 or 7 years ago. And now I have this scar, and it's like maybe it's dark humor, but I look at it and it's like, oh, hi, Don. Don left a mark on me, and
right.
And I heard a term one time that said scars are tattoos for better stories. And I don't mean that to be flippant, but that was just showing me the power. They say time heals all wounds or whatever, but there is an element to that, but. And I certainly don't say that I have everything that, every little pocket of grief in my body has been, released, or you're ready to be, like I could walk on water or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But But I do good to share these kind of things with folks, mm-hmm. so you can see that, you know, even the worst stuff, you know, like you were talking about PTSD, you know, whether it's abuse from the church or the military or having a Cain and Abel relationship with your older brother, these things do come to pass. And this kind of stuff, because I really admire the work you do. I think that's amazing. I don't know that I could do that, but sharing our stories. I know they used to say that in 12-step meetings and stuff, that, you know, mm-hmm. you're only as sick as your secrets kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
you know, but you also have to make sure that you're sharing in a safe space. So, you know,
yeah.
I figured it might be a safe space to share that. So that's all I wanted
yeah.
to say.
No, thank you. Again, I mean, I join you in the idea of, you know, scars. There's an expression, follow no one who has no scars, right? Not open wounds, but that's, you know, because there's some distance. We're not living in the there and then, you know, we're living in the here and now, right? And we have perspective, and scars are a sign of healing, and they're reminders. And that's where, you know, earlier you said, it doesn't mean, forgiving doesn't mean we just let people continue to, you know, damage or you know, hurt. And so I think one of the impacts of different kinds of abuse, certainly childhood, is that our boundaries can be really either inconsistent, maybe too rigid, too shut down, or too open, not knowing, you know, what a healthy boundary is, not knowing really how to trust appropriately. And so the healing part, the forgiving to me, is when we let go of the stuff that gets in the way of our own sense of self, we take up our own authority. So other authorities have had an impact on us, so how do we then rethink and take up our authority to manage our own boundaries? And I think forgiveness is not like some kind of negligence or anything flimsy. And the other piece that really strikes me is we have to use our voice. We do have to share stories. We have to speak the unspeakable. Right? There's so much healing when a person can share their story and what has been not just, you know, difficult to understand or difficult to live, but what has been unspeakable. You know, that allows a shift in us. Then for people to have more perspective and to see more of the situation, and then comes back to then not just honor our own experience in the past, but take up our authority now. Speaking those stories. And I often laugh at my own stories, you know, and other people that I work with. To me, that's a beautiful sign of healing, when people like to describe in terrible stuff. And we're laughing because it's like, yeah, I was messed up. You know, and it's like, it shouldn't have happened. It would be like a terrible movie to watch that. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe it. But there's distance, right? And people have strength, and they're not holding it so tightly. So, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for letting me share that.
Yeah.
Thank you, both of you. And I think I'd like to share, this is Annie
mm-hmm.
Margis, and I would like to share a little bit about my experience being a survivor of childhood assault and dealing with death. And the first thing I want to mention is the death of my abuser. He never apologized. He was still inappropriate with me on his deathbed. He never stopped. And I didn't forgive him. I wanted to. I really wanted to. And I kept hoping he would say he was sorry, you know, a deathbed confession or something. That didn't happen. But I really wanted to forgive him, but I don't, because he never quit. He never quit. The most I can ask for, I think, is being desensitized to the memory of it. But he's not getting forgiveness out of me. I'm sorry. I maybe I'll be more mature someday. But right now there's no forgiveness for the dead. And the other thing about the dead and child abuse I wanted to mention is my mother, who is also deceased. And before she died, about 6 months before she died, she asked me if my father ever did anything to me. And I lied. I said no. I could not face discussing it with her. I couldn't let the genie out of the bottle. I had to stay hidden in there. Couldn't talk about it. And I was thinking more in terms of her than in terms of myself, because she had to come to that place in her life where she was willing to admit it. Because she had never mentioned it. Nobody had ever mentioned the fact that he was a pedophile. But, before her death, she wanted to clear the air with me. But I didn't give her that privilege. I couldn't. There was physically no way I could have said yes. So I understand that other people in my family did say yes when they were asked that. So hopefully she got closure from them. And I think that's all I have to say on the topic of end of life. So I'll give it back to you, Dr. Romo. We have 45 minutes left.
Thank you. I just really appreciate the sharing and these experiences. Death is inevitable, right? So there's an expression, since death is inevitable, but the time of death is uncertain, what's most important? And so that kind of lends, for me, promotes a kind of urgency to be as at peace today as possible. And we just do our best, you know? So little by little, maybe, like with abusers, we'll be, as you said, more desensitized, you know? And that's a shift from being enraged. And from like wishing just ill wishing, and you know, the abusers, and they're still living. Some people would want to kill them. Right? There's this rage because that's a natural instinct or drive for us when something has been so wrong. And what you said as well about when your abuser died, many people find a kind of permission or freedom, a shift when the abuser dies. And that's one way. That's one of those markers. I mean, I'm sure it's never necessary for that abuser. Ideally, it would happen. The abuser would acknowledge, would have a heartfelt, you know, recognition of the hurt and do whatever to repair or to change and do something. I'd say so many cases that's just not happening, and certainly wasn't the case in my experience. And so many, I mean, those early years when I was dealing with lots of survivors of clergy abuse, there was palpable, you know, rage and desire to kill, you know, in those rooms. When the abuser is no longer physically present, there's often a kind of relief. And I imagine that's kind of self-protective, that as long as that person, or maybe representative of that person, you know, or group, still has some proximity to us in some way, some access, that we do have our guard up. We all are on our own schedule and of integration and, making sense of these experiences, you know, whatever they are. I just thought about, you know, with your mom, I know it wasn't safe for me to say anything even. I mean, I didn't have a consciousness about it at the time, and things were so suppressed. Years later, when I was first in touch with the abuse and the abuser, you know, my mom was best friends with this pastor. And when I told her about it, she just went silent. And that's when we stopped talking. I mean, it wasn't safe. She wasn't able to be that shield. So, you know, maybe it was kind of protective of your mom. I mean, a lot of people, a lot of survivors are so, have such good hearts and know what it's like to be hurt. We don't want to hurt others. And, you know, or I don't know, you know, maybe that's one take of it. But just because someone asks, it doesn't mean we have to, you know, tell them anything if it's not a part of our own healing.
I really like that. We don't have to tell them anything if it's not a part of our healing. I like that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's go back to Cindy and see if she has anything to add to our conversation.
Oh, I'm just listening to you, lovely people.
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
No, but it you know, it kind of struck me, like, you know, thinking about that, the moms that, like, they didn't say anything or don't seem to respond, and it just makes me think, like, how real denial is sometimes in people. And, you know, maybe it has a little bit to do with the feeling of, like, they don't know what they can do about it. They don't know how to respond it. And I don't mean just, like, specifically mothers. Like, in general, it really helped me when I took a class I took two classes, so I mix up where I got the information from. It was like, subsequently, several. I took victims advocacy and victims of crime and victimology. They were like sociology, criminal law classes. And when someone is victimized, people routinely deny it or blame that person or come up with some, they try to comfort themselves, because it's scary or upsetting for them. And so frequently the person who's hurt isn't necessarily getting help from those people. I don't know, you know, and I know there were, like, power differences. There are different, you know, where sometimes, like, I don't know if people are afraid, if they're afraid of how terrible it feels or if they're afraid of what will happen if they speak out about these types of things. Or if it's their own trauma that causes them to, like, disassociate and not be able to respond in a way that's helpful. Because one of the things that I've had to kind of cope with is that, like, the normal, like, what you think happens when you talk about what happened to you, even when you're talking to the quote-unquote right people, what you would think would happen isn't always what happens. If that information is personally threatening to them or sometimes there just doesn't seem to be a response. Like, people don't know how to respond.
Okay, thank you,
yeah.
Cindy.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dr.
Well, one, just to pick up on that last, you know, thought about people may not know how to respond, or people may kind of dissociate in because of their own trauma. I mean, Vincent Felitti, you know, the godfather of trauma-informed care because of the ACE study. I'm guessing you know about the ACE study. I can
mm-hmm.
repeat it real briefly otherwise, but, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
But maybe, so, I mean, yeah, like just adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah. And, you know, when he would talk about, here's the correlation between these adverse childhood experiences and physical health and mental health and, you know, addictions and all that, and to physicians, because his early drive was, you know, hey, if we just give people a questionnaire and they can acknowledge that happened, we don't have to be therapists. We can just say, okay, we see a correlation between this and this. Let's work on your wellness and your well-being. And just to acknowledge is really a healing thing. That's talking to somebody who's safe, who's able to respond. But the doctors, and he was telling stories that he would present and people would get, you know, start coughing or get up and leave the room. And he was saying, oh, my God, they're getting triggered. So, mm-hmm. yeah, we have to have people who are safe, you know, maybe even trained to be a container, you know, to be a witness without, you know, reacting and adding and interrupting and distracting from the person who is now kind of sharing their story. And maybe that story needs to be told many times for a deeper understanding or, you know, being able to integrate more. And so that dissociation, I think, is very real.
It is. And I like what you say. And it also just makes me think that it's very powerful just to have that knowledge. Like if somebody reacts poorly when you're trying to talk about what you've experienced, that it's about like their struggle instead of being like, you know, mm-hmm. for me, it's like instead of being like trapped in that mindset of bad things are happening to me because I'm bad and, you know, and people don't care and that's why they're acting like that. And it's like, mm-hmm. you know, it's a shift to be an adult that loves yourself. And when somebody else, you know, is having trouble with whatever the conversation is, just recognizing that it's, that, you know, that's their struggle, right? And you know, I mean, and even
yeah.
like therapists don't know everything and they can get even triggered. And so it might be even more powerful and helpful to the person who's going for help. Just like they say, like, you know, when we just admit, like, I'm having a hard time right now and it's not your fault,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Hmm.
It's very good to know that your therapist isn't God or,
yeah.
you know, like even if you go to somebody who's like assigned to help somebody who's recovering from abuse, everybody sort of responds and reacts differently and really learning to self-comfort. That's just powerful, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And forgive people for not always responding the way we want them to.
Yeah. Yeah. So two thoughts. One is this question of what you said right now about, you know, if somebody has a reaction, we don't have to think that it was us. We can reframe it or understand, oh, maybe it's actually they're getting uncomfortable or triggered. And then what I mentioned earlier, that belief that sometimes survivors taking up the advocacy role kind of have this sense of if I let go of this rage, somehow it's betrayal. You know, somehow I'm like less committed to making sure that nobody gets hurt in the future. And there's a great question that I like it when it's facilitated, but, you know, we could probably just on our own journal or, you know, think of it and ask it many times. And part of this is from, I do traumatic incident reduction, and it's a methodology, it's not therapy, but we often repeat, you know, a question again and again. So the person kind of like the plates in a cafeteria, you know, you take one off and the next one springs up and take one off, that our deeper understanding a lot of times is kind of buried under layers of what we and stories we tell ourselves. So the question is, what stories might we be telling ourselves that might not be true? What stories might we be telling ourselves that might not be true? And I've experienced that. I hear it in your example about someone else having a reaction and see it with others. And yeah, it gives us a deeper understanding of really what's going on, not just the first thing we think because we've internalized we're responsible for everything or, you know, that there's something wrong with us or any number of things. And just we can really question and develop like we would have in a sense with meditation or TM, thing, a little bit more space between that automatic thinking and maybe something more, you know, maybe something deeper. And maybe we can then say, oh, maybe that's not true. Yeah, actually it's not. What is true? Bingo, there I go. So it empowers us. It we take up our authority back to that again. Again, the disassociation piece is the neurophysiological response, right? We get triggered, or other people get triggered by hearing something, and all of a sudden the chemicals are rushing through the brain, and it does disconnect a bit, and a person is less able to respond, right? So they're not responsible. They're not able to respond. No, they can't respond. Anyway, thank you. We appreciate.
Thank you too.
What
yeah,
you bring
very
in.
Much.
Thank you. All right. Before we go on, I just want to do a little station identification. This is SCAN Radio Show. Stop Child Abuse Now, and this is show number 3391. All of our shows are recorded and archived, and you can go on the website and listen to any show, and we've done over 3,000 of them. Excuse me. Our website is NASCA.org. That's NAASCA.org. And if you want to be a part of our conversation, please call in. Phone number is 646-595-2118, and I'll answer the phone and let you in. Okay, and now we'll go back to our conversation, and I think it was Robbie's turn to comment.
Okay, well, I'm thoroughly enjoying everybody's insights, and the one thing that kept striking my mind when we were talking about some of this stuff, you know, when we were talking earlier about the church and school and, like, your mom not being able to, you know, handle the truth of what you were talking about, Annie, is when we're growing up, you know, in a dysfunctional home, and, you know, of course, it's always a matter of degree, but when you're a child and these things happen to you, you think this is normal, you know, and to you, your coping mechanism is about, you know, you have to make sense of it, you know, and as an example, I mean, using my mother and father as an example, my dad, the old pandemic, the Spanish flu, you know, my dad was born in 1920, and his mother died, and his father took the kids and basically dumped them into an orphanage, and so he lost track of some of his siblings and things like that. And then my mother was a ballerina, pretty successful ballerina in World War II. And, you know, Adolf Hitler came into power and kind of messed up her whole career and life and everything else. So on one hand, you know, I have empathy for the craziness that they had to go through. But at the same time, you know, my dad was very much a 1950s kind of dad, you know, workaholic. And I had mixed feelings with my father. He wasn't entirely unemotional, but he was a cop. He was a military policeman for 20 years. He had a life in the military. And so, you know, he had a hard time sometimes showing emotion. Or, you know, one of the things I remember is you couldn't be angry. You know, that was like a taboo. It's like you know, anger was not allowed. It was allowed for him, but it wasn't allowed. You know, as a child, you weren't allowed to be angry at him, you know. And so those kind of situations to me, I think, you know, it's like, you're kind of living in a fun house in a way, and not really a not fun house, but I mean, things are distorted, and I think we carry that, you know, and I forgot who said that, but it was something about like what you think is wrong with you. You know, you walk around and you're always thinking, you know, why am I so messed up? What's wrong with me? And it turns out a lot of times, especially like the designated patient, you know, the one child who's saying the emperor has no clothes is the one everyone says is crazy. And the truth of the matter is that's usually the person who's not crazy. So, you know, these are lifelong issues. You know, this isn't something that, you know, you can just figure out going to a, you know, seminar or meditating or whatever, you know, it's cumulative. And I like the analogy, too, of, like, it's kind of like an onion, you know, like you're talking about the plates that were popping up. It's like an onion. You're peeling off layer after layer after layer. And then the only thing I would say for myself is I try not to make that my entire life's focus, and not saying that in an arrogant point of view, but I just realized, because I did all these seminars and things, so I was like a self-help junkie, and I finally realized that, you know, this isn't something that, you know, it's not a destination that you're necessarily going to land at in this lifetime, you know. So anyway, those are my thoughts.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Bobby.
You bring up your dad was a cop, and he's a military police, you said?
Yes.
And I've worked with patients who've had, you know, backgrounds like that. You know, one case comes to mind, you know, a guy was a detective. And he saw lots of terrible things, you know, and he was like, kept it all kind of under control. I think he probably drank and so on, but he functioned. But at the end of his life, this guy was so terrified. And he wasn't even aware of where these things were coming from. And it was awful to see, you know, these are things that he couldn't face fully. He just compartmentalized throughout his life. And I think that's what nightmares are intended to do. They're intended to give us a little bit of relief, even though it's terrible, but to get some of the stuff out of us, to give some expression, you know, again, to speak the unspeakable. And with that idea of compassion, you know, I certainly felt that for that person. With my dad, you know, he's a violent alcoholic, very simple man, poor, barely any education, and, you know, on his deathbed, he shared some stories about when he was growing up that were really horrible. He's a horrible childhood, and he got it as a horrible childhood, and he passed it on. But it was really helpful to see, it's like, oh my God, this is what happened to you. And that's kind of one of the classic trauma-informed responses is not just what's wrong with you, you know, why are you so angry, why are you, you know,
yeah,
an addict, but, you know, what happened to you that, you know, got you to lock things down or numb out or, you know, act out and, you know, and hurt others. And that's a real gift. I think whether it's you or someone before mentioned compassion, it's different from empathy. I mean, we can certainly feel deeply with others, but to be able to somehow be present in a way that allows someone else to go through their own metabolizing what they need, you know, transforming what they need, and that we kind of walk with them, that's kind of like a hospice practice. That's a different, a trauma-informed, you know, TIR, traumatic incident reduction, is a facilitator. There's kind of a practice. But compassion, one word in Hebrew, one version of that word is womb. And so think about, it sounds strange, but think about, you know, the womb doesn't do the work of, you know, what's developing, right? That has its own process and it's a turbulent process. The womb is just the container for that, you know, to allow that to happen. And that's ideally what we could be for one another. And no doubt that's what we look for in others, even if they may not be the safe, you know, person, container, or, you know, kind of witness for us. But, you know, when we can appreciate that in our own experience, you know, compassion for ourselves, I think it allows us, you know, for like what we've been carrying around, what we've, not just what happened to us, but then what we've internalized, and maybe even because of that, what we've done to others. When we can have compassion for ourselves, that we're limited, that some people are in therapy because of us, then we can maybe then also see others, even if they've been hurtful, that, yeah, what happened to them. So I just, at the end of life, back to, you know, kind of the topic, that's really common for, especially with men who have suppressed a lot and dissociated a lot for that to show up at the end.
All right, thank you. I have another story idea thing to talk about in terms of death, and that is in terms of my own death, facing my own death.
Yeah.
And it's knowing that I suffered a lot in childhood, and I suffered through my adulthood as well as a consequence of what I was taught. And I'm angry about that. I've worked hard in recovery for many years now, and I feel like I'm kind of over it, except not the anger. I'm not over the anger. And I feel cheated out of life, and I feel like, you know what, I better get another 30 years because I haven't had enough fun. It was too hard. I need to have some fun now. And so there's that, and then there's also that feeling of it's not fair. I'm okay, but I had a friend pass away last year, younger than me, and it wasn't fair. That's not fair that somebody just gets sick and dies like that, you know? And so that's what I'm looking at towards death, even though it's not staring me in the face, is that when it comes, it's going to be not fair because I didn't get enough time. The end.
No, the beginning. The beginning. That's you know, so there's this app that I have and recommend. It's called We Croak.
I love We Croak.
Okay. So that gives all these, like sometimes philosophers, sometimes just poets or celebrities, and there's some really thought-provoking reflections, you know, through time about and through different religious or philosophical traditions. But I think that's why I said it's just the beginning. It says when we recognize that, you know, if death is certain, but the time of death is uncertain. What's most important now? So how do I make this day the best I can be? I'm looking right now at looking for different of these quotes. Here's Carl Jung, right? He says, "But when you die, nobody else will die for you or instead of you. It will be entirely and exclusively your own affair. That has been expected of you through your whole life, that you live it as if you were dying." You know? And it's often when people are in hospice or kind of they know that they're dying, their health is really, you know, declining, that people focus. And that's why I said it's the beginning. Yeah. Is life fair? I don't know. It's a lot of messed up stuff. So like, what am I going to do? You know? So that's, to me, that's one of the gifts of facing our own mortality. And besides the sadness and the, you know, all that part of it, is it can sharpen our own attention. It does for me. It's been an amazing, you know, daily journey, you know, to walk with others and learn with them. Yeah. My favorite expression is Lila Watson. She's a New Zealand activist, poet, teacher, writer. She says, "If you're here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you're here because your liberation is bound up in mine, then we can work together." And so I get this opportunity to walk with people as they're wanting to share this journey about getting more free, becoming more free from the past stuff that is residual, that is not helping us, becoming more of our better self and focused and paying attention to what's most important. So that's what I said. I think it's a good beginning. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you. Super. Well, we've got another 15 minutes on the clock, so good for us. This is Scan Radio, show number 3391, and our topic tonight has been the end of life issues and how it affects survivors of child abuse. And how about Cindy? Would you like to comment again, Cindy? Or ask a question?
Oh, if someone has a question, let them go ahead and ask.
Oh.
Or are you asking me if I have a question?
No, I was asking you.
I think it just cut out really quick, so it kind of sounded off a little bit. I just appreciated what he was saying about, I don't know who that woman was, but, you know, walk with me. Like, I don't always need help. And because I talk about sometimes, you know, the history of abuse and things that have happened. I know it didn't just happen to me. I know that some of the responses are, you know, that it's more, like if you're interested in me and my experience, then that's part of what I'll talk about if we ever are really close. And at least if you want to know that part of me. And when I talk about it, it's not just for me. It is for me, but I know that it also has to do with a lot of people have gone through. And so it's not, when we talk about, like, here we are and we're survivors of abuse, it's okay to, like, need a hug and condolences sometimes and support and encouragement. But sometimes we have things to say that are just important. And so it's not looking at people who are talking about abuse as just, you know, people who are stuck in their victimhood, because there certainly continues to be enough brutality in society to make us all realize that these are conversations that are important and meaningful, and we have to stop being afraid of them all the time.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Roma, would you like to respond to that?
Sure. I mean, it brings up, you know, the fundamental question some people would say is, like, who are we, what do we want, and what's our purpose? So however we answer those, but I know that part of our purpose, and I see different philosophers and teachers as well, all kinds of people who think of, you know, we're here to help one another. Anyway, we're not alone. And our stories are what we've learned is not just for us, you know, it's for others. And in fact, if you take the two words of illness and wellness and cover up, you know, the ness, or the LL-ness, right? It's I. You know, there's illness in being isolated or just kind of getting stuck in our own story. There's healing. There's wellness in we and connecting and hearing somebody else's story and all of a sudden being more aware of something for ourselves so that we can then work with it or let go of it. And I mean, so we're wired to connect and our stories... I would say our stories may start out as victim stories, and then I think of, you know, survivor is descriptive, because a lot of people just get through things. I mean, and then continue to live in kind of crisis mode, you know, partly because that's how strong the impact of, you know, those environments or experiences that we've had to survive. They keep us wired, and it's hard to reset and back to. How great to meditate, to do things that are grounding, because it helps us to counter the flow of chemicals to keep, you know, us on high alert and can be bad for our health. But That's not a, to me, that's not an end point. You know, I do think there's post-traumatic growth. I know that. And I know it's not a linear process, but I would just point beyond surviving and identifying as a survivor. I mean, I don't want to put down anybody who's genuine. Someone wrote me today. I hadn't spoken for years, and she said, you know, I'm a cancer survivor. It's like, yeah, you did. You got through that, and now you're living through it. So part of our story may shift, you know, from the victim story to kind of a surviving story to more of a, we're teaching from our experience. We're not reliving it. And what a gift, you know, what a testimony to our own spirit, to for other people. You know, because that allows us, I think, again, back to compassion, to be able to be present and be a resource in a healing way that we didn't necessarily have, or that certainly that we need more of around us. So thank you.
Thank you. This is what I just wrote down, a little list: victim to survivor to teacher to resource. What a beautiful list of steps to take in growth, from being a victim of childhood assault all the way through surviving it, doing okay, teacher, helping other people who have been in that situation, and then being a resource, retiring maybe from active helping people, but being a resource when people are looking for that. I just think you're so brilliant, Dr. Romo. Everything you say is just amazing. You don't have to respond to that.
Thanks.
We have 7 minutes left. And how about Robbie? Would you like to have another say?
Sure. First off, I've really enjoyed this program, and I've really liked how everybody is being so forthright and honest and really vulnerable. And I guess what I would mention is that I think it's really important the company you keep, and that doesn't mean that, you know, if you have relatives that don't want to talk about stuff, or you have friends that can't handle, you know, your depression or your sadness. I think it's really important, at least I'm speaking for myself, is to find, you know, a core group of friends if you can, or support groups, you know, whether it's 12-step or your church or whatever. But I really do think it's important to be able to share stuff without shame, and let me put it this way, share stuff with shame, but not worry that you're just going to get more of what you've already, you know, had to deal with in the first place. And I think, Annie, I know the work that you've done, and the radio show that you have is, you know, a great place for people to be able to do that. And so I just want to say thanks. I thought it was very informative and inspiring.
Thank you,
Robbie.
I want
to thank everybody. You talk about brilliance. I mean, everybody has so much, you know, and I appreciate that. The collective wisdom is how we can actually have deeper insights and collaborate in some ways, but or produce, you know, a recording that maybe someone else will find valuable. Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we've got about 5 minutes left, and so without getting into something new, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about NASCA again. NASCA is the organization that brings you this radio show. This radio show is called SCAN, which stands for Stop Child Abuse Now. And this is show number 3,391. And all our shows are recorded and archived. So if you want to listen to it again, you can on our website, which is NASCA.org, NASCA.org. And NASCA stands for National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, NASCA.org. And let's see. This show used to be on 5 nights a week, but it isn't at this time. We took a hiatus and are only on Tuesday, Wednesdays and Thursdays. New schedule. I'm pretty sure that's it. Wednesdays and Thursdays. So if you've tuned in and there's been no show there, that's why, because we had to alter the schedule briefly. We are looking for people to be on the show. On our Wednesday shows, we rather than have a survivor professional like we did tonight, we have a guest speaker. And anyone can be the guest speaker. All we want is for you to come on and tell your story about your childhood, your adulthood, how you approach recovery, how you're doing now. That's what we want to hear. And so, and it's not that scary. It's really not that scary because we're here to support you when you do it. And it is such a help to other people to hear your story. I know when I was early in recovery, I was amazed to hear that other people had the same incidences that I did, that they went through the same things. I was just totally amazed by that. And your personal story may have an event in it that somebody else is going to go, oh, man, that's me too. Wow, I'm going to get into recovery too because that person's better, so I can get better too. So I just totally believe in the storytelling being a way to heal. You help yourself and you help the listener. And I know when I was first starting listening to other people's stories, I would get really mad. I had an anger problem. But anyway, I would get really mad at the people who hurt them. I would be like so furious, I just want to go out and kill the people that hurt them. And it took me a while, but I finally realized, wow, I'm defending them. Why am I not defending myself? You know? Because I have nothing to be ashamed of. I'm not guilty. Anyway, telling stories, I recommend it, and I hope that you'll come on in the future and be one of our special guests, or you could just be part of the panel. And the panel is just whoever calls in, as we have tonight. We have Cindy and Robbie on our panel with Heinle and me, Annie, being the co-hosts. So
hey,
that's
Annie,
what
can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Does Dr. Romo have a website or anything that we can do to stay in touch or anything like that?
Yeah, please.
Super.
It's just my name, JAIMEROMO.org. And, yeah, please be in touch. And I will probably be doing a traumatic incident reduction facilitator training. I'll probably do it online so more people can access it rather than where I am here in San Diego. And I'll have some information there. But yeah, please, JAIMEROMO.org.
And you know, Annie, I'm sorry, you were probably going to do that anyway, but I just want to make sure I got that information.
Yeah, no, I forgot, but thank you. And now I have to play the going out music. So thank you everyone who listened. Thank you everyone who participated. Thank you NASCA for bringing us this radio show. And here's the end of the show song.
Thanks everybody.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was-